FM Vancouver Reloaded, playing your favorite tunes and mouth-humping your ear holes full of voice talk. Yeah, we do that.
Welcome to Transition State.
This song, it's not too short, it's not too long. It's got backup vocals in just the right places. It's got a few losing odds, and it takes a little pause just before I sing the airplane. Please play this song on the radio. Almost every line is sung in time, and almost every verse ends in a rim. Only problem we had was writing enough words. That's okay, cause the chorus is coming up again now. Please play this song on the radio. Please play this song on the radio. Time. Some shithead will be drawing a fat fucking line over the title on the back sleeve. What an asshole! So Mr. DJ, I hope you already made your segue, or the FCC's gonna take a shit right on your head. You can't play this song on the radio. You can't play this song on the radio.
It was a cold night, and the snow lay round. I pulled my coat tight against the falling down. And the sun was all, and the sun was all down. And the sun was all, and the sun was all down. I am a poor man, I have wealth nor fame. I have my two hands and a house to my name. And the winter's so, and the winter's so long. And the winter's so, and the winter's so. All the stars were crashing round as I laid eyes on what I'd found. It was a white crane, it was a helpless thing upon a red stain with an arrow in swing. And it called and cried, and it called and cried so. And it called and cried, and it called and cried so. And all the stars were crashing. I laid eyes on what I found. fly. She stood to fly away. And all the stars were crashing round as I laid eyes on what I'd found. My crane wife, my crane wife. My crane wife, my crane
my name, woke with somebody when the morning came. No one there to shame me for my youth, 'cause it wouldn't be with you. And then I found me a lover who could play the bass. He's kinda quiet, but his body ain't. Spent the days dreaming and the nights awake, doing things we know we shouldn't do, 'cause I wouldn't.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
What's up, radio fans? You're listening to Transition State on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. As always, I'm your host, Adam. We just heard some Rin Weaver. That was Pierre. Before that was The Decemberists, The Crane Wife 1. And before that, we heard an oldie but goodie by NoFX, which was Please Play This Song on the Radio. Well, I'd like to talk about that music, but I have a bang-up interview that I want to get straight to. It's going to take up most of my time this week. Earlier this week, I sat down with Mr. John Chasky of Howsound Pharmacy, and I'm going to play what he had to say right about now.
Hi, John.
Hi, Adam. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. So I definitely know who you are. We have a relationship going back a few years, but some of my listeners may not, so maybe I could ask you to start just by telling us a bit about who you are and what you've been doing.
Okay, then, of course, Adam, I'm John Chasky. I graduated from pharmacy in 1978 and did a residency in 1978-79 at Vancouver General Hospital. And I found that hospital residency really, really good because I learned a couple of things. First of all, about therapeutics and the way we did things in those days, which dovetailed very well into what is taught in today's world and used. So I was very lucky that way. And as well, at Vancouver General Hospital, the administrator, the person in charge of the hospital pharmacy department, was very big on workflow. And he taught me a lot, directly and indirectly, because I had to use the system. And I learned the principles. And because I learned the principles of it, how could I apply it to other situations? And I think that that's where my passion is how can we best look after the people, both with drug preparation and distribution, and for clinical outcomes, and make it all work.
Okay, I really wanted to ask you about that. So some of my listeners, regular listeners, will know that a lot of the times pharmacists tend to go in one of two routes. One is to the community, one is to the hospital. And generally, the hospital residency you mentioned is for people who want to go into hospital pharmacy. But you are now pretty firmly on the side of community pharmacy.
And that's an interesting point, is that I'm not anywhere. In fact, I'd say I'm right in the middle, because a lot of the principles that we used in the hospital, let's say like a stop order, we don't let prescriptions just dangle in suspense. It's either there because the person is taking it, or it's not in the file because they're not taking it. Yes, it's in their history and everything, but we have the stop orders or whatever it is. We use the same principles as the hospital. As well, I really believe that we're going to have to stop this community versus hospital because of the handoff of the patients, more and more so, from the hospital to community and from community to the hospital. Everybody's going to have to understand what it is that that other person does, because the more you understand that person's job, the better it is you can hand off to them and have it prepared. So I feel I'm in the best position. Maybe I don't execute it as good as some other people could, but because I understand it, I don't believe I let my pharmacy drop the ball because of not understanding what is required. And that's what needs to have to happen. And we might need to do something where even says for a year you have to do one or the others, whatever it is. I mean, it's not insurmountable, but we have to change.
Okay, so like a bit of a false dichotomy there.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. That you have to know each other's work. Just like it's great, I had a course with David Fielding way back in fourth year where I went to 13 different health disciplines, and our goal was to learn about that other discipline, but to teach what pharmacy could do for them. But because of that, to this day, I understand what those people need to do a job effectively from me and what I can offer to them. So I feel the handoff is so important, especially with the interdisciplinary fields that we have to deal with today.
Okay. And you mentioned the 1970s?
Yeah.
So what have you been up to lately? What are you doing now?
What I'm doing now really in the last 5 years is taking everything to a next level with documentation. Documentation is key and has been a problem in the medical sort of field profession for a long, long time. And for pharmacy, we really haven't documented anything really well. The drug preparation and distribution part is the clinical part, not so much. So since the BC Medication Management Pilot Project, which had a wonderful research tool for documentation, but not for clinical aspects, we've converted a program into what we can download from our pharmacy program to our clinical program and fill in the blanks where we need to. We've learned from our marketing department, which we're very lucky to have, how to communicate properly and effectively to the doctors with really, really little amount of information, but the key nuggets and everything. And doing it that way, we've been able to really, I think, improve patient outcomes and be at the forefront of what we're doing today.
Okay. You mentioned documentation, so that kind of tangentially reminds me of something that I really want to ask you. So I'm still a student, and we haven't really got a lot of exposure to like the medical record management, but it seems to me that it's mostly done sort of per physician office. So say I'm working at a pharmacy, and I have a patient in front of me, and I have some questions, and I want to know, then I pretty much have to call their doctor's office and get their records. If I have a relationship with them, it might not be a problem, and they'll share it with me. But the system is that I, as a pharmacist, can look up this person's information, and the physician can look up their information, but the person themselves can't.
Right, and this becomes a real problem. I was under the understanding that we were going to have a card. It was going to be our driver's license, our medical card, and it would have all our medical information. You just scan it. So, in other words, you're giving a consent by just being in front of the person and giving them a card. By giving the card, you got the consent. You could look at things. And then by having all that information, we can make a far better decision. Same with the doctor, that if you're in a different area, such as if you live in downtown Vancouver, you end up in Prince George because you're on holidays and you need to be seen by the doctor, you'd have all that information there. And it's very easy to do because we do it financially, we do it securely, as you know.
Yeah.
And so why aren't we doing it in the medical field? So it's very frustrating, especially when we have people, going back to our previous conversation about handoffs and everything, where you get handed off a patient from hospital and there's no documentation. You don't even know why they were in the hospital. So are their meds changed? Are they not changed? What was added? What was subtracted? And it makes it very difficult. So we've become hunters of information,
right,
as opposed to using our clinical knowledge and all the knowledge around us to come up with the best solutions. Now we're detectives. So
is there any movement to bring forth a system like that?
Well, I don't know of any movement. That's the problem, is that it seems to be government run and it's at the whim of the government. So they might want to do it, or somebody might have that desire, but is it possible? Do you have the people in place that actually could execute it? And I'll even question that. Are the people that are around, are they actually able to do that? Do we need a bunch of young people that knows all the technology and everything to make this work?
Young people. Okay. That reminds me of a question. So I'm in my fourth year of pharmacy school, and I'm about to graduate. So do you have any advice for new grads?
It's the same advice, actually, that I got. And I remember this at Vancouver General. There was two gentlemen that were in the compounding area, and they were very interesting in that they were separated out from the young clinical people that were out there.
Okay.
Doing, you know, the drug preparation distribution part to some degree, and, of course, the clinical and the floors and everything. And they took me aside, and it was funny because there's these two guys you never heard from, or they talked to you or whatever, but they were on their own. And they said, don't ever take a job less than the one that you want to be at. So in other words, like, don't think you're going to be a vice president of Shoppers Drug Mart getting out of school. But the thing is that if you want to be a manager, you take a management type role. If you wanted to be an owner, or a vice president of an operation, you need to do that. So it's really important that you don't settle for working at a place that's just drug preparation and distribution if you want to be a clinical pharmacist. If you want to be a clinical pharmacist, go to that level right off the bat. Look for that. And when I think about it, that's what I did, management and clinical right off the bat. I've never been lower, not that it's higher or lower, but you know what I mean,
right.
A manager or doing any clinical work, because I just will not do anything that's just about drug preparation or distribution.
Okay, so good advice.
Yeah.
Okay. What was your first job then after your residency?
After my residency, literally, I had two options. One was a regular pharmacy job, because I realized I did not want to be in the hospital system. But going to Penticton, I realized it was a regular drug preparation distribution job.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a good question lead in here. The other one was to Gibson's, where it was a clinical pharmacy, in those days clinical. Remember, we didn't even have record plans at that time. But I thought, hey, because we don't have it, I have the freedom to do it. That's where I'm going, and I'll do it for 3 months. So I guess I'm on month two now. In Gibson's from 79. I mean, the calendar is sort of off a little bit.
Well, it's been 36 years.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Okay, I guess you chose right. That is good advice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Then I'm also really curious, in that 36 years, what changes have you seen? Like, what are the most biggest changes that you've seen in
pharmacy? Actually, that's a really good question about what's the biggest change. And I would say in British Columbia, it would have been the PharmaNet system in the summer of 1995 would have been the single biggest change. However, also you can look at when I brought in August the 11th, 1979, the patient record plans, where I literally wrote in everything to check for drug interactions. And, when you look at those two changes, actually probably 79 would have been the biggest, because with that information, it doesn't matter whether it's PharmaNet or not, there was a change from simply what was on the prescription, what was in the bottle, to, okay, now we can explain to the people what they need to do, how they can take their medication, looking for drug interactions, putting a rudimentary type care plan together, though we didn't use that terminology. That's what we were doing. Unfortunately, with my previous job during university as a mechanic, there were your care plans for your car. So really, it was just natural learning that in the hospital and then moving it into community.
Okay, so it sounds like you're talking about patient-centered care. You take medications away from the center of what the pharmacist is, put the patient in there.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we did. So really, when I think back, that was a good question, that the PharmaCare system or the PharmaNet system specifically was a big step, because then we got to see what was going on in the entire province. But the actual big step was 1979, when we had the patient record cards.
Okay, and just for listeners who might not know, the PharmaNet is the province-wide network
with
where
the data.
Every drug that's dispensed will be recorded for every patient.
Well, probably about 70%. There are a lot of exceptions, and that's the problem. So you have to remember, you take that information with a grain of salt.
Oh.
There's the HIV meds, the cancer meds that are not there. If you get anything out of province, it's not there. So it's not 100%. I think of it, when I'm looking at it, it's 70% accurate. What else could be there to go wrong? Unfortunately. So
over-the-counter medications they can
exactly
take,
that
right.
A lot of people don't put in. We in the pharmacy, that's schedule 1, 2, or 3 drugs, mainly go in the PharmaNet system first, because in our care plans that you do have a lot of OTCs in there, and to have it download from your pharmacy program to your EMR,
mm-hmm.
you need to have it there. So we got more information, but it's still not complete.
Okay. And I'm really curious, has this move from medication-centered practice to patient-centered care, has that paid off financially?
Another good question as well. Absolutely, because what we're doing is, you have to remember, I don't have a marketing background. In fact, don't ask me to market anything.
Okay.
Probably there's some experiences out there that have gone way overboard.
Okay.
We do have a marketing department, and they look at the big picture. It's not the three-month financial pictures that drive what you do. It's what's best for the patient to develop loyalty. And by developing loyalty over the years, all of a sudden your financial credentials become very, very big.
Okay, so at first maybe not exactly. A big game, but in the long term.
In the long term. And, you know, this goes with any industry. You have to look at Warren Buffett with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway. He wanted a return instead of in 3 months, in 10 years. And marketing really screwed it up because they're doing so well. In 7 years, they're giving money back to him. And he's saying, what are you doing with this? You know, you're supposed to come back in 10 years. So I think that shareholder model might work for certain things. But to be honest with you, I think it inhibits a lot of work. So that's another situation that I would not want to work in, where your results are 3 months, because you can't develop loyalty of any sort to any customer, no matter what industry you're in.
Okay. Do you feel like there are a lot of other people in the industry who share your views?
I don't think there's a whole bunch of people, because you have to remember, really, I believe, this is just my own opinion, but 70% of the people are still in the drug preparation and distribution model, and it's cloaked in different things. And they do some very good clinical work, so don't get me wrong, but it's still not in a situation that allows for the optimum amount of outcomes. However, there's about 30% that really, I believe, are out there, and we need to cultivate those people. So the people that want to be fully clinical, the ones that want to do the outcomes to their maximum, they need to go, as I said before, and this comes back full circle, to a point where they're only working in those type of environments. If you like to be in drug preparation or distribution, which we need, then go ahead and do that as well. There's nothing wrong with it. So we have to be very careful of how we use the terminology, but determine where you want to be, and I'd say it's 70-30 right now.
Okay. I just want to say a disclaimer before I ask the question that we're not endorsing any pharmacies or anything like that, but I'm curious if off the top of your head you can name a few pharmacies that you know that are doing good work?
Well, absolutely. There's two amazing pharmacies. That's How Sound Pharmacy and Peer Health.
Okay. So a little bit of bias there.
A little bit of bias. Because
but you said 30%. There's more than two, aren't there?
Absolutely. There's a whole bunch out there. You know, you can go to Kelowna with the Lakeside Pharmacy. In Vancouver, there's a lot of different ones that are happening, like McDonald's, where they really are very good with their compounding, their renal, and all that sort of stuff. Those are the type of places that you want to look for, and you can tell right away by their workflow. There's some that do an excellent job that are in chains and everything, and they might just focus on diabetes or something. If that's what you like to do, those can be good as well. But find out who your team is, because the team influences how they interpret what the corporate entity wants you to do.
Okay. And do you have any advice for somebody, say a new pharmacy owner who's just opening a pharmacy?
Yeah, you better get some better pay some good money for a lawyer,
okay,
an accountant, because no matter what you do, you're going to need them, and get a consultant in pharmacy that has actually done the work. You need to get somebody that is a pharmacist, or was a pharmacist. I mean, you could be retired, you know, if you wanted to be, but has the actual experience, because they have to, how did they apply the principles? We can have people that are business people, but look at what that has created over the years and how it's changed things in pharmacy for non-pharmacy people to be doing things, and they don't understand the nuances of what a pharmacist needs to do. When we're in the trenches, we're in it together. And so I would say that if you could get those three people advising you, and they have experience, so obviously the lawyer and the accountant, very rare are you going to find them as pharmacists, but handle other pharmacies and knew the nuances, then we're doing pretty darn good.
Okay.
But the consultant for the pharmacy, what have they done? And how have they implemented in the past to show you that they can implement the principles of what's going on, not just, well, I read about this, I'm a business guy.
Right, okay. And say you're sort of lawyer shopping and one seems like a good deal, but one person has experience with pharmacy, you're saying it's worth the extra.
Absolutely, with the nuances of pharmacy and with accounting as well, gee whiz, because I can talk to the accountant We can talk very fast about professional allowances versus staffing. He understands marketing, that what we're trying to do is something over a 10-year period by developing loyalty. So he understands that we have a higher payroll, for example, than normal pharmacies would have, that our cost per prescriptions are lower. He understands all those nuances. So when we're talking, I'm not having to explain all the groundwork. I might have to give him a little bit of background to something that we learned from PharmaCare the day before, but that's about it.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. What's the biggest challenge for independent pharmacy owners today?
I think the biggest challenge today, I'm going to say there's actually two things, but the biggest one I'm going to say is the PharmaCare system. Rules change very quickly sometimes, so you can't even plan. So you have to plan for the unplanned,
okay,
first of all. As well, I believe that the third-party payers, including PharmaCare and the other private extended care plans, are going after pharmacists for technicalities. Now, on one hand, you can say, well, if you can't dot an I or cross a T properly, that prescription is not worth anything. However, my concern, and this has happened both in the pharmacy industry and where I can speak of in the railway industry, where overregulation on those things have actually become hazardous on the outcomes. So with pharmacy things, they're making mistakes on the prescriptions. On the railways, they were actually going through restricted areas because they were worried about a date, how it was written. And it was specifically dealt with. And as soon as that issue went away, you know what, May 25th or 2505, 2015, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because the outcomes could have been disastrous. And the other item with the pharmacy is that there was a 7-point thing that you're supposed to do, and that meant going to see where the toilet paper was for somebody, but stopping a clinical outcome, which resulted in some errors. So it's been shown that there's too much regulation.
Okay.
So I think we really need to have the right touch, which is regulation by ethics that says what's best for the patient. If you can prove what's best for the patient, that's good. Is writing the postal code, which is in the computer anyways, best for the patient?
Maybe not, yeah.
So that's what I'm worried about now.
And so do you do that personally? Like, you have to keep up with all the changes and all
You
the
see,
things?
And that's the problem, is that I have to keep up with all the changes to make sure I understand the workflow that's going on in my pharmacy, and if I'm helping anybody else, to say where they could fall down on. And this is where I particularly see, hold it, you're working 2 hours on a Sunday for something that should take a half hour. Now, how good are you going to be on Monday coming into work because you're checking on something that happened on Sunday because of some artificial rule that's in there? This is just not good. Or literally, I have people that just would never want anything to go wrong in the pharmacy. They take the job so seriously that they're worried again about times, date, whatever it happens to be, and not focusing totally on the patient. So that worries me. And that's why we always have extra people on staff, because it's actually better to make a little bit less money and have less people stressed.
Right.
So, it is a bit of a thing. And like I said, two ways of looking at it, but what's the ultimate reason why we're all here? And same with the third-party people. If you didn't have your customer to pay those premiums, you're out of business.
Right.
So, and same with the government. If you don't have those people paying the taxes, you're done too. So you got to look at it. What is the ultimate goal? And I think that's the biggest advice in running a pharmacy I can give you.
Yeah, I see. It's so easy to lose focus on the patient, right?
That's right. And they're the ultimate. And it doesn't matter who actually gives you, Adam, the cash. It's who is there initiating the payment.
Okay. Do you like music?
I do like some music, absolutely.
Okay, I really want to continue this conversation. There's a whole bunch more I'd like to ask you, but right now I just want to break for a song. Is there any song you'd like to hear?
Oh, boy, I tell you. Well, since it's pharmacy, let's go with Cocaine by Eric Clapton.
Okay, here's Eric Clapton on CITR 101.9 FM.
Song not available.
Okay, then I'll play it. So we'll come back. You good?
Yeah.
I figure like 20 more minutes?
Sure.
Okay.
What time is it right now?
9:45.
Okay.
Okay. And we're back. How did you like that, Eric Clapton?
Oh, excellent. That should be a corporate theme
classic,
song. Yeah.
Classic
music. Classical music, exactly.
Okay. I'm really curious. What got you into pharmacy in the first place?
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, you know, of course, I knew, working at the gas station, that I should go to university.
Okay.
You know, I was learning a lot. I was learning to be a leader. I was learning to do basically developing care plans and diagnosing
for cars.
As a mechanic for cars. Ah. But the principle is the same in dealing with people. But somehow I knew I needed to go to university, which I was doing, and I was actually enjoying it. So at that time, I just knew to continue on. It's funny, you know when to leave, too. I was looking at, you know, there's medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, and everything. And somehow, did I want to really be a doctor? Because in those days, they were still doing a lot of house calls, on call, like even today in Gibson's, I was talking to one of the doctors the other day, and, you know, the anesthesiology, the being on call all weekend and everything, I don't need to do that. So I'm glad I didn't do that. And then dentistry and everything interests me, but also, you know, mechanically, why wouldn't I work on cars rather than mouths? Because, you know, it didn't really excite me. And then when I went to pharmacy, I realized, hey, there's so much potential to change. Because the university, I have to say, the faculty, even at that time, was looking for change. And they introduced it to me, of what we could be doing for the patients. That excited me. It really excited me. So off I went.
Okay. And then after all these years, what keeps you going?
Again, the patient outcomes. It's funny that you asked that. Very well done, I have to say. But the point is that it's about the patient. And that's the biggest challenge, is that because I've learned how to grease the wheels to make everybody else do their stuff, that's what I don't like, is I'm doing the greasing of the wheels instead of being out there with the patients.
Oh, okay. So that's a drawback.
So it's a big drawback. Don't be so good.
Got it, hands off. Okay.
Yeah.
If you were, like, the king of pharmacy, you were in charge of everything, what changes would you make to, like, the way we practice pharmacy?
Okay, that would be actually the pharmacist getting the prescription and intake, because then you talk to the patient, you deal with the patient up front, and any changes, you find out what the actual goals are of that patient, and even if it's hospital where you haven't talked to that person immediately, but you have a care plan there, you can see if everything jives, and then edit the prescription. That's what we called it at Vancouver General. Edit the prescription and have it to way it meets that patient's needs.
Okay, so I worked at a pharmacy as a student, and so I wasn't really doing any of the official pharmacist work, but usually the first person the patient would see would be me. I was at like a cash register. They would come up with their prescription. I would check if they had allergies, simple stuff, and then I would take the prescription kind of behind the second counter to the pharmacist.
Yeah.
And you're saying you would bring that pharmacist up front, so the first person that they talk to is an actual pharmacist.
Absolutely. And then when I look at the mistakes that have gone on and been reported in the media in the last few years, that method would look after the old method that caused the problems. So I'm very particular about not relying on computers for like DUEs and things like that, that the pharmacists identify what they are worried about with DUEs in the first place to see whether they're significant or not, the drug interactions. They can check Lexicom or any of those other programs for drug interactions. And then it's verified by somebody else, so you're not being overloaded by all those messages all the time.
Right.
And I feel that's so key. And then by learning what the patient wants, that it becomes a good workflow for those people in the drug preparation and distribution. So it helps everybody. It's not, gee, this helps this person, but it doesn't help that person. It actually improves the system immensely all the way through. And this is a system from the 70s. It's not new. It's just that everything evolved because it was so much easier for the person at the lowest pay to take a prescription and just take it and get it filled, and the pharmacist would have to check it in the back. Well, that's not needed anymore with the pharmacy regulated technicians and things like that. And there's a lot of pharmacists that just want to check, and that's fine too.
Okay. So back at that old pharmacy I was at, that was the workflow. I would hand the prescription off. Pharmacist would usually type it in, what we call typing. I wasn't even really sure what they did. And then I would go, I saw the prescription, so I would go get the drug, count it out, and have it kind of ready, labeled, and the pharmacist would check it and give it out.
Yeah.
So then I'm pretty sure in response to your idea for change to put the pharmacist right up front, that pharmacy would say something like it would take way too long for the pharmacist to first of all talk to the patient and edit and then go back and do the typing and then go count the medication and then check it. Doesn't it take them like an hour?
Sure. If they were doing everything, I guess it would take them a long time, especially because the pharmacy assistants and regulated techs are a lot faster and better at what they do because they're doing it all the time. So you have to have a team, and you have a typer that's making $15 or $20 an hour, a regulated tech $25 or $30 an hour. So you have efficiencies there. And they're doing all the technical stuff. I don't even want to handle a computer anymore at data input because it's getting more and more complex. And if you're not doing it all the time, you're not efficient.
Okay.
So you can be a pharmacist doing that, but how can you also be talking to the patient? And also, what liability are you opening yourself up to by not doing all your work up front?
Okay, you mentioned pharmacy assistants and registered techs. Now, I was a pharmacy assistant at the time. You don't really need any special training to be a pharmacy assistant, but you're not really given any responsibility. You won't be the one checking or doing certain things.
That is correct.
So it makes sense to have them do some of the work for efficiency. But what exactly is a registered technician?
Registered technician is a licensed person by the College of Pharmacists. The one thing they can do that a pharmacy assistant can't do is check prescriptions.
So that's taking responsibility that it's the right medication and the right number and the right amount.
That's right. All the things that are all correct and signing off. And actually, in our pharmacy, they are the final check to ensure for me that the pharmacists have done all their work. So really, they have become the actual managers of the pharmacy in small M's, where I'm the actual ultimate as the manager at House on Pharmacy. But our pharmacy technicians will go back to the pharmacy. And I got caught last week. I was working with a student, and I realized after our we went through everything. The consultation was good. We found out what the patient wanted. Everything was done. I said, perfect. And we caught a drug interaction that was okay to have. I signed off on it. It went to the typer. It went to the filler. It goes to the checker. The registered tech comes back to me and says, John, this needs to be adapted. The patient won't be taking it this way. They'll be taking it that way. Oh, and of course I go, yes, you are correct. Hey. So because I was more focused on what the student was doing and everything else, I didn't do my job. So the registered tech said, this prescription hasn't been done properly. It goes back, and it went back to me, and then we have to go through the whole process again.
Checks, but that's okay. And balances.
Checks and balances.
Okay.
Because they know. So they may not be able to interpret. They're not able to make decisions, but they knew that this job was not complete.
That reminds me of an experience I had when I was a student at your pharmacy, and I had to count out. I was counting out 360, I can't remember what it was, but it was a narcotic prescription, so I counted them twice. 360, and I'm a pretty good counter, but your registered technician caught it because there was only 359. Pretty tight operation, I thought.
I know, and that's the thing is that that's why I don't even want to touch it anymore because I can't do it properly like that. And the thing is, they catch all that sort of stuff because that's what they do. In their mindset, they're looking for X equals X, Y equals Y, whereas I'm looking for the abstract. What does the person want? How do we want to do this? What can we do better? And if my mind's going there, I can't be doing that other stuff. It's just physically impossible.
Okay. I'm really curious. This might not be a happy thing to talk about, but have you ever made a mistake?
Actually, I've made probably a whole bunch of little mistakes. I probably have not made any big mistakes. When I look back at it, I've been really lucky over my career that I don't think I've really made any major mistakes. They've been all the dumb little things, like missing five tablets.
Little things.
Or spelling mistakes.
Right.
Or all those stupid things. Or forgetting postal codes and then having somebody go over them in the old days or something like that. I would say those are the typical things that you have to watch for. And so those are the... But when I look back in my career, I really can't think of anybody in Gibson's that we had a major problem with. I think that there's lots of things that have been on their way out, but because of all the checks and balances I've always had, I think that a lot of those have been caught. And definitely when I think about things, you know, wrong strengths and everything have been on their way out.
And they get caught.
But they've all caught because of the system. I think that's what has done it for me.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that probably the biggest one is like the spelling mistakes or the miscommunication with somebody where you say, where you're talking to them is twice a day and the label says three times a day. Things like that. Those sort of things that need more clarification than anything else.
Good. That's good to hear.
So So I've made the boo-boos. They've been caught.
As long as patient safety is concerned. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Do you have any, like, a proudest moment you look back on or some accomplishment that...
The proudest moment would probably be the team when we did the best... BC Medication Management Pilot Project, and we did 7,000 encounters, and the way everybody pulled together. And I think that that was a good example of leadership. Not so much mine, but I was able to hang up a goal that was set by the researchers, and that the team stepped up and they did it. So I'd have to say that if I had one highlight, it would be getting 20% of all encounters in the province done at House Owned Pharmacy in Gibson's.
20% of all the encounters in
BC.
The whole province were done at one pharmacy?
Yeah.
That seems impossible.
Because what we did was we basically, I held up the vision, the team believed in it, they wanted to help people, and we executed it.
Okay. What about what's next? Do you have any goals for the future?
What's next is probably to help other pharmacies follow a model. It doesn't have to be exactly like House Owned Pharmacy, but a model that will improve patient outcomes.
Okay, so help sort of spread the word.
Absolutely.
Okay, do you find people are, what's the word, open to...
Some people are very open. Unfortunately, I have to say that on a Facebook page recently, it's the railroaders, my friends that have stepped up, and non-health professionals that have seen what we're doing, and they're all, wow, this is great. This is what I want to experience. No wonder you're so busy all the time. You know, like that huge groundswell of support. I would say people, you know, in their day-to-day lives don't want to change, afraid to change, aren't in a position to change.
Right.
So I would say there is, to be blunt about it, a lot of resistance. But when you look at their situations, a lot of these situations, very easy to change.
Is it just that people are resistant to change? Or like,
yeah,
why?
Yeah, I would say resistant to change. I mean, just think about all the changes that have happened over the years. Even with the telephone, it was invented in 1879, whenever Watson did his thing Bell and all that sort of stuff. And you have to remember, the telephone really didn't come into its own until the late 80s and into the 90s, because really it was still just a thing that you dialed in and you got somebody. And even in the 60s and 70s, there was party lines and all those sort of things. And what was the difference between the 20s and the 70s? And all of a sudden, for some reason, the barrier was broken, and now look like what we do with the phone system.
Yeah, think of the generation now.
Yeah, it took 110 years to change anything.
You can't take away their phone now.
Now they get shaky.
Okay. It seems like it would be really awesome to be John Chasky. Is that true? Is it awesome?
Well, I like biking. I like outdoors, so I think it's great to be me. But I don't know.
Sometimes they say it's lonely at the top.
It can be. I do have to say, and that's part of it. With the BC Medication Management Pilot Project, I did find that everybody was fairly equal. And I do like my staff, particularly the technicians. If I do anything wrong, I get hit in the back of the head like anybody else. And I really like that because I'm part of the team.
Right.
But I do find that people are, wow, you do this, you do that. You know, I'm just another person. And, and so you do feel a little bit lonely at times, is that, well, who do you talk to? Or I'm just worried about this. Or I don't like that. Who do you talk to? to.
Yeah.
And so it is. It'd be like Alexander Graham Bell, I guess, since we're talking about it. He couldn't just call up somebody on the phone and just say, well, what do you think about this?
No.
There's nobody out there. So.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, those barriers, they kind of sneak in out of nowhere.
They do. They do. And unfortunately, it just happens.
And then you mentioned that you used to work as a mechanic.
Yeah.
And that right out of school, you've been managing Housetown Pharmacy. So, but you also mentioned the railroads.
Yeah.
How does that tie in?
Well, because I learned the jobs when I was very little, because you would be babysat by different people on the passenger train.
Okay.
So your parents or who was looking after you, like my grandfather, could go for a drink and a smoke in the lounge car. You would get to learn stuff. And then by chance, I got to learn all the jobs. And it progressed to a tour company. The tour company progressed to an opportunity to work on the railway. And on the railway, I have to say that I had some amazing experiences, including being trained by Frank Scobie, the father of Francis Scobie, the astronaut in the Challenger.
Oh, okay.
And so I learned what went into being an astronaut. Like, how did you grow up in, you know, rural Washington to become a PhD fighter pilot and everything else? Well, I learned how you're treated to be not fearless, but to be able to think anything is possible. And that's probably our biggest barrier, now that I think about your previous question, is that anything is possible. A pharmacist that's worked in a garage can now run this train and actually hurdle mile-long trains uncontrolled, but stop appropriately by training, by confidence, and being patted on the back and everything else.
That's amazing. So this was all before, like when you were still young? Before pharmacy school?
No, I was a pharmacist as a manager when I became...
But you said that your grandfather, you would have to be babysat.
That's when I was really little. I learned all the jobs of what it meant to be a conductor.
So you kind of fell in love with the trains.
I fell in love with the trains, and they make a lot of sense to me traveling. Like, I don't have any downtime. 15 minutes and you're on the train, you can be back to work. You don't have to be told, put your thing on airplane mode and all that sort of stuff. So actually, it's a very efficient way to actually travel, door to door, all your work and everything. So,
okay, and then it was later as a pharmacist, you kept riding the trains, and that's when you met.
I have the tour company, so I met people, and through one way and another, I learned how to be an engineer.
I definitely have a soft spot in my heart for trains. I can't remember when I was young, but I lived in Japan. They certainly take their train system quite seriously, and it's a great network. Have you ever been to Japan?
No, I haven't.
Oh, man, you would like the trains there. On time. Unbelievably on time. And I was in Europe, too, this summer, training around. Really beautiful, through the Alps, beautiful stuff. Is there any particular train ride that stands out to you?
Well, that's a good question about train rides. You know, with me, I would say that the train ride from Jasper to Prince Rupert is the most amazing, beautiful train ride there absolutely is anywhere, because you're going from the Rocky Mountains to the High Plateau to fjord-like inlets and all that sort of stuff. So,
where is Prince Rupert exactly?
Prince Rupert is 450 miles up the coast.
Up the coast. Oh, okay. That would be a nice trip.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the longest trip you've ever done, Mickey?
That would be, Vancouver to Halifax.
No kidding.
Yeah. No, there's
all
a couple
the
of transfers. Yeah, I'll do that. In fact, probably do it every year. I've got a lot of business to do in Moncton for the tour company, and also pharmacy stuff now in Newfoundland. So, of course, obviously I'll fly from Moncton to Newfoundland, but I find that I can do the train, my work on the train, and I'm not out of communication, and so I don't have that darn lag time where, even if it's a day, because you're like, when you fly from Toronto to, or Vancouver to Toronto, it's your day is shot.
Yeah.
And then you have to catch up. And then on the way back, you have to catch up on all your work that you missed. I don't have that problem. In fact, I've been told coming into Vancouver on the train, don't you want to take the day off? You've been away for so long. And what it is that everybody's afraid that I'm going to ask where the work is, that I've been sending them back, and they're not ready for me. So I do have to say that for my type of job, it's worked out really well.
Okay. How long does that take then to train from Vancouver to Halifax?
That would be 5 days.
5 days. But you get like a sleeper car. It's pretty comfortable.
You get a dining car. Good food, dining car.
You can stand up and walk around.
Champagne.
Yeah, you can work. You got all the work to do. You got the window to kind of look out.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that's what gets me focused. There's PowerPoint presentations that I did 10 years ago that I have to say are 100% perfect. And I think it's your mind turns off, it turns on. It turns off, it turns on. And there's something there. I can't put my finger on it. But I do have to say that I've done my best work on the train, uninterrupted, of course.
And plus, I feel like slowly, like bit by bit, plane seats are getting smaller.
Yes, and then when you're a biker with your legs, my legs,
yeah.
I've even been taught by the stewardess how to sit because they stick out so much.
Yeah.
So it's not comfortable. I am not comfortable.
Okay. I think we agree on that.
Absolutely.
All right. Is there anything that we forgot to mention?
No.
Well, thanks a lot for being with us, John. Very enlightening.
Thank you, Adam.
Okay. Good luck in the future.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that incredibly professional interview with Mr. John Shasky. That's about all the time we have for this week, radio fans, so I'm going to leave you with one more track. This is NoFX's Drugs Are Good from their album HoFX. Enjoy, and until next week, stay pharmaceutically aware and also in tune.
Dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband Tom and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it.
So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
Yeah, check it out. I found that canned ham and I put it in a pot of boiling water and guess what I'm calling it?
Soup? hot ham water.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, nourishing radio.
So watery, and yet there's a smack of ham to it.